France and Britain were nervous about this. They didn't want to alienate Mussolini too much. But Hitler, on the other hand, warmly congratulated the Duce on his successes in Ethiopia and pledged support for the venture. Then, of course, Italian involvement in the Spanish Civil War. Mussolini's support for the anti-republican forces led by Francisco Franco would also produce troubles between France and Britain on the one hand and Italy on the other. France and Britain would be drawn in a very, very lukewarm way to support the Republican forces in Spain. And this, too, tended to chill relations between Paris and Rome. By 1936, with Hitler, who had also intervened in Spain on behalf of Franco, Mussolini was already speaking of a Rome-Berlin axis, and in 1937, fascist Italy joined Nazi Germany in the so-called Anti-Comintern Pact, which bound the two together to ward off the spread of international communism. Although confronted with German rearmament, the weak coalition governments of the Third Republic could not take decisive action to modernize or expand the French military establishment. It is one of, to examine the paralysis of French military policy from the mid-30s to the end of the decade, to those terrible days of May and early June 1940, is to watch a government which and a population which knows the danger that lurks beyond the Rhine and simply cannot arrive at any kind of national consensus about how best to meet it, how to spend for an expanded military establishment. After 1936, then, France discovered that it basically could only follow, quite reluctantly, in Britain's footsteps, acquiescing in the policy which came to be known as appeasement. British policy, which by 1938, when that Munich conference was convened, Britain had adopted a policy which, from very early on, reflected its concern that the Treaty of Versailles had been harsh and possibly responsible for the rise of the Nazis. In the 1920s, Britain had grown mistrustful of France. It believed that European recovery required the re-entry of Germany into the international economic system. And Britain came to see France as absolutely obsessed by a desire for revenge, bent on establishing French hegemony on the continent at all costs. Indeed, by the late 1920s, leading British policymakers were convinced that the treaty had been unjust and that its terms ought to be revised. In this situation, as Britain looked around for support and looked at the international system, looking across the ocean to the United States, the British governments, successive British governments, were convinced that the United States was of little or no strategic help. Franklin Roosevelt, after 1932, would find himself beset by an isolationist Congress and population, and not inclined, although Roosevelt himself could certainly see the mounting danger of the situation in Europe. There was very little that he could do to involve the United States in a forceful way in European political life. By the mid-1930s, Britain had gravitated toward the view that the best way to restrain Hitler was to meet just demands, justified demands, not from a position of weakness, not to cave in to the bullying of a tyrant, but rather to, from a position of weakness, of strength, to deal with the Germans, to listen to their desires for revision of the treaty, and to accept, to go along with, to meet those desires, those demands for a change in the status of the treaty. The British military establishment in the 30s also confronted problems. The army was quite small. There was no peacetime draft at this point. The Royal Navy was still the world's largest and most powerful.